The following audio is from The Well. We are a church that is committed to gospel growth, family formation, and missional engagement in Hastings, Nebraska. More information about The Well can be found at www.thewellhastings.com. We hope the message you are about to hear will spur you on to growing in the gospel of Jesus Christ, to be formed as a follower of Jesus, and to be engaged in the mission of Jesus to seek and to save the lost within a yard of hell.
Good morning, church. My name is Michael White, and I'm a leader in training here at The Well. Our passage today is 1 Samuel 22, verses 6 through 23. If you don't have a Bible with you this morning, you can turn to page 230 in the Bible underneath your seat. If you don't own a Bible, please feel free to take that Bible home with you. It is our gift to you. Please stand with me if you are able for the reading of God's Word so that we may honor Him together. Now Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with a spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, 'Hear now, son of Ahitub.' And he answered, 'Here I am, my lord.' And Saul said to him, 'Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, so that he has risen against me, to lie in wait as at this day?' Then Ahimelech answered the king, 'And who among all your servants is so faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, and captain over your bodyguard, and honored in your house? Is today the first time that I have inquired of God for him? No, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all of this, much or little.' And the king said, 'You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house.' The king said to the guard who stood about him, 'Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me.' But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, 'You turn and strike the priests.' And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep he put to the sword. But one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, 'I knew on that day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul. I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping.'" You may sit. Dear Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you for this morning that you've given us. I want to thank you for the voices of children the proof that this church is alive, that there is a new generation that is being brought up to know you, to love you. I just thank you that we can come together in safety and security to hear your word and to grow closer to you. I just pray that you would be at work this morning. Open the eyes and the hearts of your people. Just pray, give me the words to speak, to proclaim your truth. Pray that you would be glorified, that your will would be done. In Jesus' name, amen. Right, before I get going, just want to let you know, today will be a little bit different for me. Joe wanted me to run off some bullet points for this sermon, so that I would get my eyes up off the script. I do have a copy of the script over here on the other side, so even if this goes poorly, I do have a last resort, so hopefully it won't go too horribly. So we shall see. We shall see. So as you can see here, the theme that I'm going with is God's sovereignty in the midst of suffering, in the midst of evil. You can see this in Saul's nepotism, in Doeg slaughtering the priests, and in Abiathar hiding with David. As far as context goes, back in 1 Samuel 2, there was a prophecy to Eli regarding judgment that none of the descendants of Eli would ever live to an old age, that they would eventually be removed from being priests before God. There's some other pieces of that I'll get into later. In 1 Samuel 8, there was prophecy of judgment on the people of Israel. They had demanded of Samuel to give them a king, and Samuel faithfully proclaimed what God had for him and said, hey, this isn't going to be what you think it's going to be. There's going to be selfishness. There's going to be nepotism on the part of the king. In 1 Samuel 9, we see Samuel go and anoint Saul to be the next king of Israel. But even at this early stage, we see Saul showing signs of sin sickness within himself. As we fast forward through to 1 Samuel 15, we see this sin begin to blossom as he finds himself unable to obey God with respect to the Amalekites. God had told him, go destroy these people that have been harassing the people of God for as long as you guys can remember. Take them out. They're evil people and they need to be dealt with. Justice needs to be done. Saul could not do that. He rescued the king of the Amalekites, king named Agag. He also rescued the best of the flocks and the herds of the Amalekites to offer up as sacrifices to God. But that's not what God wanted. That's not what God called for. God prefers obedience over sacrifice. 1 Samuel 16 and 17, Samuel finds David and anoints him as the next king, and then God uses David to rescue and redeem Israel from the clutches of the Philistines, and specifically from Goliath of Gath. And then in the next few chapters, chapter 18 through 22, we see a description of the closeness of David and Jonathan's friendship. We see Jonathan effectively acknowledging David as the incoming king and submitting to him. We also see that contrasted with King Saul's bitter, jealous hatred and his paranoia of David. He's afraid of David because he knows that David is far more of a man than he will ever be. And not only that, that he is favored by God and that he himself has turned from God and lost God's favor, lost the protection of God's Holy Spirit over him. We then see David running, escaping. See that David wants to save his own skin, you know, and he goes so far as to run into the hands of the Philistines, those who knew who he really was and were probably more terrified of him than he was of them, you know? I mean, think about it. This kid came in and wiped out your 9-foot-tall giant, you know, a warrior among warriors. What do you think he's going to do to all your normal, like, 5-foot-4 guys? That was kind of the average height back then, you know? Go to town, you know? Turn on the old lawnmower, you know? And in the following chapters, we're going to see, all the way to the end of the book, that God continually delivers David out of the hand of Saul, out of the danger zone. We're going to see that God gives David victory over the enemies of Israel. And we're going to see that as this happens, as he runs, as he fights, that David's being shaped into the man of God, into the king that Israel truly needs. And then when this process has reached appropriate level, I guess we'll say, it's never fully complete, but when it's reached where God wants it to be, God delivers Saul over to the hands of the pagan Philistines for his own judgment. Because Saul has abandoned God. Saul has turned against God in the worst of ways. And so he must face justice. Now, there's a lot of pieces, a lot of details to this passage, but I want to be clear here about the core theme, the thing that ties all this together. This passage isn't about Saul's selfish paranoia, nepotism, and unjust judgments. Certainly part of it, but that's not the whole thing. Not really about Doeg's lying, violence, and false conversion, though that's also certainly a piece of this. Not about David's regret and his leadership, part of it. Not about the passivity of the guards. Not about Abiathar's sorrow and desperation. Ultimately, the thing that ties this passage together, the underlying heartbeat that makes it come alive, is God's plans and his sovereign control of the circumstances for his own purposes, even in the midst of suffering and evil. And this plays out in three separate scenes. There is a scene on the hill of Gibeah. There is a courtroom and the city of Nob, and then there's David's hideout out in the wilderness. So let's kind of take these three in turn. First of all, we got to consider Saul's nepotism. How in the world is God's sovereignty on display through Saul's nepotism, through his giving of gifts to his own people? Well, let's dive in. When we look at this passage, what we see is King Saul sitting on a hill under a little tree with a spear on his hand. He tries to project this sense of safety and security, like, you know, hey, I'm bold enough, confident enough to be out in the open, you know, come at me, bro. But it's a fake safety. Really, underneath all of that is a deep-seated fear. I mean, think about it. Here he is in Gibeah, which is deep in the heart of the territory of Benjamin, his tribe. It's on a hill, so he can see all the way around him, you know. He can see anybody coming close to him and be ready for it. You know, good luck trying to ambush this guy, right? And then, you know, he's got his servants and all around him, you know. These servants, these guards, they're members of his own tribe because he doesn't trust anybody else to have his best interest at heart. Certainly not those guys down across the border in Judah. I mean, people, nasty sheep herders, you know. Who would want to trust those guys? And then we see here that in the midst of all this, he gets word that, hey, you know, David's been found. Like, look, here he is, you know. And what does Saul do? How does he respond? He begins to rant and rave to the people all around him. He disrespects David, calling him the son of David. He doesn't even bother to call him by his actual, or the son of Jesse, rather, sorry. He doesn't even bother to call him by his own name. You know, this, in this culture, refusing to call someone by their name was a sign of disrespect, dishonor, disgrace. Is to basically say you are nameless, you are worthless. And then he accuses, or, well, he asks rhetorically, hey, you know, is David, you know, is the son of Jesse going to give you fields? Is he going to give you vineyards? Is he going to give you military commissions, make you, you know, officers in the army, you know, give you all these positions of prestige and wealth and power? And, you know, when you look at what how he says that, you know, there's, there's a few different things that you can pull out of it, you know. First of all, you know, he disrespects his own son-in-law, you know, someone who has been a faithful friend, a faithful servant, someone who has fought on his behalf over and over and over again. You know, he's basically saying, hey, you know, David's totally going to engage in nepotism with his buddies, you know, the tribe of Judah over there that we don't get along with very well. But in doing this, Saul effectively admits that, hey, he's engaging in nepotism. He's giving preferential treatment to his family members, his kinsmen, his tribe. He's treating them better than everybody else, and in doing this, he's causing suffering for the people of Israel, because in order to give those gifts, he kind of has to take it from somebody else. Not to get too deep into the subject, but it kind of reminds you a little bit about communism, you know. Take from those who have and give to those who don't. Or at least, you know, to the people who rank high in the party, you know what I mean? And so, you know, he basically admits, hey, I'm a dirty, rotten guy, and because I'm a dirty, rotten guy, I expect everybody else to be a dirty, rotten guy, you know? And at the very end of this, he accuses his own son, his most trusted bodyguards, of being traitors. They must be traitors. They must be lacking in compassion, because they didn't tell me what was going on, you know. You know, kind of this victim mentality, if you will, you know, of I'm going to, you know, blame you guys because I don't want to take responsibility for myself. And yet, in all of this, we see that God is sovereign, because God already said ahead of time, hey, this is what's going to happen. And it happened. And the reason it happened is to discipline the people of Israel for demanding a king, for wanting to be like everybody else around them. Because guess what? Everybody around them were terrible people, evil people, people who did not have God, who did not know what true good was, and who rejected it, honestly, most of the time. So, yeah, God shows his control here by saying, hey, this is what's going to happen. It's going to happen, and here's what I'm using it for. But moving on from that, we then ask, hey, how does God show his sovereignty in the slaughtering of Nob, the city of the priests? I mean, these are his guys. These are his servants. I mean, if he's really in charge, shouldn't he be taking care of these guys? Well, back in 1 Samuel 2, remember, there's this prophecy from an unnamed prophet talking to Eli, and he says, hey, you know, you guys, you're going to see the distress of God's dwelling. And, you know, first we see this in the Philistines raiding the city of Shiloh, stealing the Ark of the Covenant, and then, you know, ultimately having to return it humbly. And then we see it again here and now with the destruction of the city of Nob. He said, hey, you know, you're going to see this distress of God's dwelling in the midst of good for Israel. And we see this, you know, first in the person of the prophet Samuel. God blessed Israel through Samuel repeatedly and gave them good leadership, godly leadership, a loving leadership. And soon we're going to see God performing good for Israel through the soon-to-be King David. Also in this, it was promised that in Eli's descendants, there would no longer be any old men, that they would all die in the prime of life, that none of them would be able to develop the wisdom of age. And subtly, this was a, hey, you know, all your guys are going to get killed, and it's not going to be pretty. But in the midst of this, he then promises to preserve a remnant for the house of Eli. Think about that, the mercy of God in the midst of judgment. But even that mercy is itself a judgment, because he promises that this remnant will grieve, will weep, will feel deep sorrow and suffering over everything that's happened. And then the final bit of this prophecy, God says, hey, you know, you guys, you had your opportunity, you had your chance, and you blew it. I gave you all these gifts. I let you be my priests. I let you basically get fed and clothed on the backs of my people Israel for minimum work. All you had to do was show up on Sunday morning and worship me, practically. You know, I mean, just imagine that if your job was just basically to show up here and sing and enjoy fellowship together, and you got paid more than enough to cover all your needs. That'd be pretty awesome, wouldn't it? You'd feel pretty blessed, you know, pretty privileged. And yet, these guys, they took that, they despised it, and they threw it away. And so, God is throwing them away. They will no longer have access to that office. They will no longer be able to be priests. So that's the background here. You know, as Saul's, you know, ranting and raving, his servant Doeg, the Edomite, speaks up and he starts to spill the beans. Hey, you know, I saw David, you know, over here at the city of Nob. He was talking to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and guess what, you know, this guy, this priest, you know, who's supposed to be your ally, you know, he was doing you dirty. He, you know, he went and inquired of God for David, you know, asked God to help David out and show him the path forward. And he gave him bread and gave him a sword and all this. And, you know, it's strange, you know, you stop and you think about it, you know, we saw this brief mention of Doeg just a chapter ago. And in this brief mention, we find out, hey, you know, here Doeg is, you know, he's Doeg the Edomite, he's been detained before the Lord, and he's the chief of Saul's shepherds. The Greek translation of this original Hebrew changes out the word shepherds for mules, but it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense other than perhaps an editorial note that specifically the shepherds that he was over were in charge of the king's mules. But all that aside, you know, Doeg the Edomite, he had this position of social power, of influence. He would have been rather wealthy because of his position serving directly underneath the king, being in charge of all of his flocks, basically, all of his animals. And you stop and you think about it, you know, here he is. The text repeatedly, insistently even, refers to Doeg as the Edomite, right? You know, it insists on his ethnicity. And when you look at that, you look at him being detained before the Lord, you know, regardless of the reason why he was there in the temple, you know, whether it was, you know, suspicion of leprosy, whether it was because he was fulfilling a vow, whatever it was, it gives a sense that Doeg wasn't exactly thrilled to be in the presence of God, you know? Like, man, I gotta be here, I gotta do the thing, I gotta show up, I gotta, you know, check all the boxes, and then I can go about my day, right? At the end of the day, what this points to is that Doeg wasn't actually a true convert to the worship of God. He didn't truly love God. In fact, really, he was just going through the motions. He was really just a wolf in sheep's clothing, pretending to be something that he wasn't, you know, basically impersonating a true worshiper of God. And why? Well, to protect his position in society, to protect his wealth, to protect his job, to protect his rights even. Because you look at Old Testament law, there were special protections for foreigners who did convert, who did assimilate into the nation of Israel and did worship the true God of the universe. And these protections weren't extended to other foreigners who still worship foreign gods. And so, you know, Doeg, he was motivated to seem to be something that apparently he really wasn't, you know? How often do we see that, you know? We wear masks and try to make out as though we're something we're not because we're afraid of people seeing who we really are. We're afraid of what they'll think of us. We're afraid of what they might say about us or do to us. And so that's who Doeg is. You know, he's an imposter looking to protect his reputation, his job, and his rights. And, you know, as far as rights go, I mean, you want to talk about real converts, real people who assimilated into the nation of Israel? You can just look at the examples of Rahab and Ruth, who abandoned everything they knew before and submitted to God, submitted to his people, and truly became part of God's story. I mean, Rahab and Ruth, they're in the family line of Jesus. I mean, what greater honor could God give to those who found out who he was and then decided that he was better than everything they knew before, right? And you look here at what Doeg says, you know, he finally gets around to spilling the beans, Interesting that he waits until this very moment when his master, his king, is totally unhinged, clearly not thinking straight, to throw out this accusation. And he follows King Saul's lead. He disrespects David just as much as Saul did. Again, you know, calling him the son of Jesse, right? And he then falsely accuses Ahimelech the priest, who is the son of Ahitub, but who is also the great-grandson of Eli the priest. He points out truly, yes, that Ahimelech had given David a sword and bread, but he weaves in lies into that. First, explicitly, by saying, hey, you know, this priest inquired of the Lord for him. We see no evidence of that in this previous chapter, and we also aren't going to see it in the priest's response to this. So it's pretty clear that he's just making this up, pulling it out of thin air, trying to tell Saul what he wants to hear, because Saul's looking for a conspiracy. Yes, we already have conspiracy theory in the Bible long, long before 2020 or any of this, you know? Yes, Saul is just a little off his rocker, you know? And Doeg plays to that. But then there's also this implicit lie, because Doeg leaves out the part where David basically tricks Ahimelech into the priest into giving them these things, because he says, hey, you know, I'm on a secret mission for King Saul, you know. Now you think about, you know, James Bond from any of the 007 movies, or Ethan Hunt from Mission Impossible, you know, guys who have a thing to do and they can't really reveal their identity or what they're about to most people, or else, you know, that'll screw things up. They have to maintain their cover. Well, David's doing the same thing here. He's saying, hey, you know, I gotta, you know, lay low. I gotta, you know, get where I'm going. I can't tell you what I'm doing, but it's totally for King Saul, right? You totally gotta believe me and, you know, help me out here, because if you don't, Saul's not gonna be a happy dude. And you haven't noticed, when he's not a happy dude, you're not having a good day. You know? And Doeg leaves that piece out, you know. It's an implicit lie, because he's withholding truth in order to help shape this lie to get Saul to believe the accusation. And it is a deadly false accusation of treason, of convincing David to betray Saul and set up an ambush somewhere. Who knows where, because Saul's hanging out on this hill, right? You know. And then, at this point, Saul believes him. Saul's crazy enough to just accept this accusation as gospel truth, if you will. And so, he sends a delivery boy. Not a messenger boy, a delivery boy. Yes, that's a Shrek reference. He sends somebody to go retrieve Ahimelech the priest and all the other members of the priesthood living there in Nob, and says, hey, come here. I need to talk to you. It's important business that we got to sort through. And if you don't show up, there's going to be some consequences up in here, you know. So, of course, you know, the priests show up. And you look at how this plays out, you know. Just like with David, Saul shows disrespect for Ahimelech, the priest. Saul basically progresses, if you will, from disrespect of God's king to disrespect of God's servants, God's priests. Disrespect of God himself, for all intents and purposes. See, while basically sliding on down that slippery slope, you know. Who knows where it's going to end. And what this shows is this a bad leadership. You know, to be king of Israel was to be more than just a political leader, to be a legal or civil or military leader. It was also to be a spiritual leader. Saul was a leader to Israel. It's just he was the wrong kind of leader. Instead of leading people closer to God, he was leading people away from God just by his example. Ahimelech hears this disrespect and he doesn't let him faze him. He responds with the utmost humility and he says, "Here I am, my lord." You know, he pays King Saul all the respects due to his office, and you know, he doesn't let Saul's words get to him, get under his skin, get him to say anything that he shouldn't say. Saul basically treats this Doeg's false accusation as being true, and he says, "Hey, you know, why have you done these things? You know, why did you inquire of the Lord for him? Why did you give him bread? Why did you give him the sword of Goliath? You know, why? You know, why have you convinced him to betray me, to set up an ambush?" And Ahimelech's like, I don't know what you're talking about, you know. Don't you know, isn't it clear that David is your faithful servant? There's no one here who is as faithful, as trustworthy servant as David. You know, and hey, he's your own son-in-law. You know, he's your family. And hey, he's not just some soldier in your army. He's not just one of your bodyguards. He's the captain of your bodyguards. He's the leader of your bodyguards. He is the most trusted man in your army for a reason. And if that wasn't enough, I mean, look at how highly honored he is. Look at the respect that he gets for your family. And to anyone else, you know, you'd think, hey, this is starting out to be a pretty good defense, right? You know, like, surely, you know, David isn't that kind of guy. But you got to stop and remember where Saul's at, where his head is at. Instead of calming Saul down, instead of quenching his anger, his fear, his paranoia, it merely stokes up the fire inside of Saul. It only makes him angrier, more hateful, more spiteful, more fearful, because this guy, he's a better man than I am, and I did kind of get this word from God that the kingdom would be given to a better man than I am, and who better to give it to than David, so I don't like that guy. Too nice, he's too awesome. Can't let him stick around here. And then you look, Ahimelech, he doesn't dispute, you know, whether or not, you know, he gave bread to David, whether he gave the sword of Goliath to David. He knows that these things are true, so he doesn't even mention it. He just accepts that it is what it is, you know, guilty as charged, right? But you look at what he does dispute. He disputes making an inquiry of the Lord for David. You know, he says, "Hey, you know, have I just started doing this today? Nah, I haven't." And, you know, given that we have no mention of him doing such in verse 20 or chapter 21, given that we know that Doeg's a liar in all these other ways, you know, we can say with a certain degree of confidence, hey, you know, Ahimelech's telling the truth. He didn't start doing it, and he definitely didn't do it when David showed up, you know. So this part is completely false. basically he says, you know, you have no evidence that I've done anything wrong. And hey, anything I did do, I did for you because you are the king and he told me that this was for you. And you look at that, you know, Ahimelech's trying to do everything he can to demonstrate his loyalty to Saul, to demonstrate his goodness to Saul. But Saul isn't having any of it. Saul rejects it out of hand, you know, regardless of what the evidence is. He takes off his prosecutor hat, throws on his judge hat, and says, guilty. Not only guilty, but you're going to die, you and all these other guys, because of what you did, because you're totally traitors. Never mind that there's no evidence that they're traitors. They just are. He just knows it in his bones. Remember, throughout history, you know, been a thing for kings throughout the ages. You know, it was something that was remarkably common in England for many years. It's why eventually the nobles and the people rose up against the king, and you know why we got the Magna Carta, why the king was forced to ratify it, because they said, hey, we're tired of you pushing us around and treating us badly for no good reason. And it's the exact same thing going on here. Saul is making arbitrary judgments and condemning people to death for no good reason. And after making this judgment, after turning against God's priests, Saul says to his bodyguards, hey, you know, you heard what I said. I gave them the death sentence. You carry out the death penalty. And his guards refuse. They just stand there like, okay, you know, we're not doing that. We are not going to lift our hands to harm the priests. Because while you might be that dumb, we're not that dumb. Right? So Saul's like, okay, fine. You're not going to do it? Doeg, Edomite, my chief shepherd, my guy, my one remaining friend in this world, you do it. And Doeg shows no signs of remorse, no signs of reluctance. He turns around and he does it. And he murders 85 men, grown men, worshippers of God that day. But notice something. The bodyguards don't do anything about it. Doeg is just one dude, right? There's plenty of bodyguards sitting there in that courtroom in the throne room of Saul, but they don't do anything. And what does this tell us? They weren't aggressively against God, but they also weren't actively defending God, defending God's people. No, they were passive. They did nothing. They were fence sitters. And because of that, God's people were destroyed. And then Doeg takes it a step further. Seemingly with Saul's unspoken permission and approval, Doeg goes to the city of Nob, the city of the priests, and he begins to wipe out everybody. Man, woman, child, baby. Wipe out all the livestock, the cattle, the donkeys, the sheep. A complete and utter destruction of the inhabitants of Nob. And before you know, you get too far away from that, remember, Saul was commanded to do this very thing, not to the people of Israel, but to Israel's enemies, God's enemies, the Amalekites. And Saul couldn't bring himself to do that. He had too much warped compassion, if you will, too much mercy for the guilty that has now become cruelty to the innocent, to somewhat paraphrase Adam Smith. Not the greatest application, but that's what it makes me think of. And so you see here, not that Saul or Doeg were the Antichrist, but that they were expressing or obeying the spirit of Antichrist, this spirit that is in opposition to God's anointed one, that turns to incredible depths of evil, that exchanges good for evil and evil for good, that turns everything on its head and says, I'm going to protect the enemies of God, and I'm going to utterly destroy God's people. And before you begin thinking too lowly of Saul and Doeg, I'd just like to encourage you to remember that every time that you and I knows what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to say, what we're supposed to think and look at, and we don't do those things, don't say those things, don't look at those things, don't think those things, or when we know what we're not supposed to do, say, think, look at, and we do those things, look at those things, say those things, think those things, we are utter traitors to God. We are in utter opposition to God's anointed one, his King, his Messiah, his Christ. To put it plainly, when we sin, we are in opposition to Jesus, God of the universe. That's what's going on. So you and I, we are Saul and Doeg in this story every time we sin. Let that sink in a little bit, right? That this is common humanity on display right now. This isn't anything that you and I aren't capable of, right? And before I move on, I just want to point out, you know, this spirit of Antichrist, it is mentioned in 1 John 4, and it's this refusal to acknowledge Jesus as King, to acknowledge Jesus as God. That is the core, the heart of Antichrist. And there's going to come one who is the utter embodiment of that one day, I believe. But that same spirit of disobedience, of utter rebellion, has been present, is present, will be present. And John's warning his people, his church family, hey, this is happening. This is going to happen. It has happened already. Be on guard against it. Watch for it. When you see it, fight against it. Because it's dangerous. Straight up dangerous. Not just physically, but spiritually even. So be on guard against it. No wonder, then, that in Psalm 52, which was preached about a year and a half ago or so, give or take, David calls Doeg a violent liar. He basically says, hey, your tongue is a sharp razor. Not just a needle. It's not just poking me. You are killing people. You are destroying things. And you look at it, you know, Doeg basically starts off by committing character assassination against the priests. He destroys their reputations. He says they aren't all that they're cracked up to be, and lies to create that illusion. But then he moves beyond that. He doesn't just, you know, kill their character in the public. He doesn't just destroy them in the court of public opinion. He then goes and actually physically destroys the people of God, the priests and the citizens of that city. He wipes them out entirely. So it's not just that, you know, he proclaims these lies, but then he acts on the opportunity given by those lies to carry out his heart's desire, which was to destroy the people of Israel. And he asks, well, why does he have this desire? Kill God's people. Well, you got to remember who the Edomites are. The Edomites are the descendants of Esau. Okay, Esau, Jacob and Esau, right? You know, Jacob stole Esau's birthright. Not once, but twice. First by, saying, hey, I'll buy that off of you if you'll, take this bowl of soup. And Esau was hungry enough and dumb enough to say, yeah, let's do that. But then the second time, he impersonates Saul, his mom says, hey, throw some goat skins on your arms and here's some cool food and some, clones, so to speak, make you seem like your brother. Go into your dad, who's now basically totally blind, and convince him that you're his older son, so he'll give you the family blessing instead of the Esau. And so he steals what is rightfully Esau's, not once, but twice. And, this creates a long-seated grudge. And here is Doeg make good on that grudge. And remember, Jacob, his name was changed to Israel. So that's, how this story comes down. It's Esau who becomes Edom, Jacob who becomes Israel, constantly fighting against each other through their descendants. So Doeg, he's here to kill his worst enemies. This is a family feud, and he's going to make sure that somebody pays. 85 priests later, a whole city later, his heart is seemingly satisfied for the moment. And you look at this great depravity, this deep, wicked evil. And you go, really? Really? This is God being sovereign? But then you stop and you remember that this is a partial fulfillment of 1 Samuel 2's prophecy that God was going to wipe out the house of Eli almost entirely. And he doesn't care how he gets it done, so to speak. He's going to make sure it gets done, and he's willing to use even the worst of us to accomplish his purposes, to exert sovereign control to accomplish his plans. And there's nobody in this world that can stop God from doing what he wants to do, right? There's nobody that can keep him from accomplishing his plans. So then we are confronted with this last scene. Abiathar escaping and then hiding out with David. We ask, okay, how's God being sovereign here? Just a scant 4 verses and barely hear anything about Abiathar other than, he got up and ran and now he's here with David, right? But then we remember 1 Samuel 2, that prophecy that a remnant was going to be preserved. Abiathar is that remnant, right? Abiathar is that one out of many that's going to be saved by God. And isn't that the same for you and I? That, the road to destruction is wide, but the gate to life is narrow? Many will be destroyed, but few will be saved. God always preserves a remnant, but it's never more than a remnant. But in the midst of all of this, you got to stop and put yourself in Abiathar's shoes, right? I mean, this whole guy just watched his whole city get wiped out. Not just his city, his whole family. Everybody that he had ever known or talked to or loved, gone. Basically overnight, right? Can you imagine the level of grief, of sorrow that plagued him as he ran? Can you imagine the survivor's guilt that must have been a burden to him all the way to the grave? Like, why did I make it and not Joe over here that was certainly more awesome than I was, right? He loved God more than me. You know, shouldn't God have saved him? But no, God picked Abiathar. He survived. So he runs to David, tells David what has happened. And David, being the man that he was, being the godly leader that he is becoming, says, hey, I'm responsible for this. It's an expression of leadership to take responsibility even for the things that aren't directly your fault, and to then express regret over the things that you could have done and didn't do, the things that you did do and shouldn't have. David says, hey, I saw that guy. I knew he was going to be trouble in the moment I saw him, but I didn't do anything. I was too worried about getting out of Dodge. I was too worried about my own needs and wants and whims to consider the danger that this guy posed beyond that moment. And there's some commentators who think that maybe the reason David was so motivated to run to the Philistines was because he saw Doeg there and he knew Doeg was trouble, knew that Doeg would try to cause him harm. But regardless, you know, he realizes that he could have done something, probably should have done something, but didn't. And then he offers an invitation to Abiathar, an invitation to be safe with him. What does this tell us? It tells us that David has a confident assurance of protection. He knows that he's been anointed to be the king of Israel, right? He knows that he has a destiny that hasn't yet been totally fulfilled. And so he believes not only that he'll be safe, but that the people around him will be safe so long as they stay in his presence. And, you know, I'm going to skip ahead here a little bit, you know, give you a bit of a spoiler. Spoiler alert! In 1 Kings 1 and 2, we find out, hey, yeah, Abiathar did stay with David, did suffer with David over and over and over again over decades, right? We see that Abiathar did stay with David almost up until the day David died. And during the entire time that he was in the presence of his anointed king, he was safe, he was protected, he was loved. Then he screwed it all up. Like we all screw it up, right? He said, hey, you know, I like this guy Adonijah, one of the oldest remaining sons of David, right? I want him to be the next king. And now, you know, you think, okay, you know, why is that such a problem? Well, in 1 Chronicles 22, God sends a messenger to David, which would have happened chronologically before this event. God sends a messenger to David and says, hey, I know who's going to be king. It's going to be your son Solomon. And David agrees, and he goes through and he says, hey, Solomon, my boy, you know, one of the youngest of my sons, you're going to be king. Not any of these other jokers, it's you. You're the man. So what Abiathar has done here, he's rejected his king, his friend, David. But more than that, he has rejected the choice of God himself by saying, I'm going to make this guy king instead of the guy that God has handpicked and that David has confirmed will be the king. And what's the result of this choice? When Solomon becomes king, after Adonijah oversteps his bounds, Solomon looks at Abiathar and he says, hey, you're not allowed to be here anymore. Go to your house over there in Anathoth. Go to your fields. I'm not going to kill you because you were with my dad, because you suffered with him, because you carried the Ark of God, because I have too much respect for my dad, and more importantly, for God, than to kill you. But you're not allowed to be here anymore. You are going to go to your house out in the middle of nowhere, and you're going to stay there. And not only that, you're not allowed to be a priest anymore. You are done. You're just going to be another, you know, Joe Blow, working your fields, making your money the hard way, right? And you don't get, you know, the cushy, you know, taxpayer funded job anymore. You know, not working for the federal government anymore, right? You know, he has to grind it out like us, you know, blue collar folk and whatnot. And you go, okay, well, where's this going? What are you trying to say? This is the completion of the fulfillment of that same 1 Samuel 2 prophecy. Because you'll remember, at the very, very end of that, it says, hey, you guys aren't going to be priests anymore. You're going to beg for it, you're going to want it, you're going to desire it, but you're not allowed in my house anymore. You're not allowed to serve that way anymore. And so we see God's sovereign control over this, his divine protection, until Abiathar departs from the presence of God's anointed king. I want you to hold on to that nugget, because we're almost there. And this is an important piece for making that transition over, right? Because here we have, you know, we traveled all through this passage. We dug into what's actually going on in terms of the events, right? But what does this actually mean for you and me? You know, how does this connect to the gospel, right? That's the conclusion here. How does this get to us to the gospel, right? Take a little kind of a sidestep to get us there. You look at Isaiah 53, what do we see? We see a prophecy of a suffering servant. Prophecy that there would be one who would show up that would be pierced through for our transgressions, would be crushed for our iniquities, would suffer pain and shame and death so that we could be saved, right? You know, this prediction, this prophecy of suffering and evil from God so that good would happen. Then we look at Psalms 41. It promises that there's going to be a betrayal of the Messiah. We look at Zechariah 11, and it spells out the price of that betrayal. 30 pieces of silver that will be thrown into the temple and then paid out to the potter for the potter's field. And you're going, okay, right, you know, where are we going? Well, in John 13, Jesus quotes that part of Psalm 41, and he says, hey, you know, this one who's going to betray me, he's the one that I'm going to dip and give this morsel to. And who does he give it to? He gives it to Judas Iscariot, the traitor. And the moment that he gives this morsel over, Satan enters into Judas. And Jesus tells him, hey, go on, get out of here. What you do, do quickly. Sends him on his way. And then in Matthew 26 through 27, we find out Judas, he goes to the priests. He says, hey, you know, what do you give me if I hand Jesus over to you? You know, what are you willing to pay out if I betray him for you? What amount of money do they pay him? 30 pieces of silver, just as promised in Zechariah 11. And then what happens? Well, Judas betrays Jesus, you know, goes up to him, grabs him by the beard, kisses him on the cheek, and that's the sign for who Jesus is, you know, who to capture. And, you know, Jesus is feeling good, like, hey, you know, Jesus is totally the Messiah, you know, he's totally going to be a military leader, so, you know, he's not going to, you know, let this stand, he's going to fight back, you know, whatever. Well, the next day, Judas wakes up and Jesus has been condemned, not just to punishment, to death. And Judas goes, oh no, what have I done? What did I do? You know, it straight up says that he felt remorse. Not a godly remorse, a godly sorrow, because, I mean, instead of turning to Christ for forgiveness, he commits suicide. He takes justice into his own hands. But before he does that, he goes back to the priests and he says, hey, you know, I screwed up. You know, you can have your money back. And the priests are like, we're not taking that from you. That's blood money. You know, that's a hitman's contract. And to take that money from you, that it would be an evil thing to do. It would be unlawful to take that from you. But Judas doesn't care. He throws that money into the temple, just like Zechariah 11. And guess what? The priests grab that money and they go, we can't keep this, so we're going to take it and buy the potter's field. Again, what was predicted in Zechariah 11, right? Why am I even talking about all of this? Judas's betrayal takes us to the cross. It's because of what Judas did that Jesus was in the hands, in the power of the Pharisees and the chief priests. And there's a lot of other prophecies that tie into this whole period, this Passion Week of Christ. I don't have time to get into all of that because we'd probably be here for a few more hours if we really wanted to dive into it. I don't want to put you through that. You've already suffered enough. God is sovereign in this suffering that you're going through right now. So I'm not gonna do that to you. I think God is telling me, Nan, don't go there. But all that to say, God, he's in control. He's using all of this. He is sovereign still in the midst of all this suffering. You know, you think of how Jesus was abused, tortured, before he even got to the cross. He didn't even have enough physical strength left to carry his own cross all the way to the execution grounds. And then he suffered on that cross. There's this word, excruciating, right? Anybody familiar with that? This word excruciating, it's meant to evoke the worst level of pain you can possibly imagine. But what it means is out of the cross. Basically, what it's saying is that the worst possible physical pain a human being could experience is crucifixion, right? That's what Jesus suffered for you and I. And not only did he suffer, you know, that pain, he then suffered death. God, the maker of the universe, gave himself over to death. He didn't have to. You look at his last words, his last actions. Any other man, human man, would be gasping for breath. But Jesus yells out at the top of his lungs, loud and in control, in charge, confident, "It is finished." Tetelestai. The debt is paid. Right? And then he gives up his life. Not because he had to, not because his body was pushed past the breaking point, but because he wanted to. Because that was the plan. Right? And think about the evil that was done to bring him to that point, to get him onto that cross. Not just the betrayal of Judas, easily one of the most evil acts ever committed by sinful man. Not just, you know, the torture by the hands of Herod, by the hands of the Romans, by the hands of the priests, these supposed holy men of God, but then death at the hands of the Romans on that cross. I mean, we're talking about some of the most grave sins ever. The only thing that could possibly compare to these is Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden rejecting all that God had given them to be their own kings, their own gods, their own Christs, if you will. And yet, through all of this, God uses this pain, this suffering, this death, this evil, to bring about salvation, to give you and I a way to make things right with Him, to give life and healing, delivery, rescue, from the presence and the power, the penalty of sin, to those who are called according to His name, John 17, who are, you know, who belong to Him, say, in John 17, who are called according to His purpose in Romans 8. So, wrap this all up. Where are we going? Where is this? How does this apply today? We've connected it to the gospel, so, okay. How are we connecting this then to you and I today? Because God is still sovereign in the midst of unimaginable suffering and horrific evil, still sovereign even in those times. Because He is, we can know and trust that when we experience suffering and evil in this life, when, not if, when, God is still in control. He is experiencing that suffering and evil with us. And He is somehow, some way, using that suffering and evil to bring about His unfathomable plans for His glory, for our good, that is our transformation into the likeness of Christ. Bring those plans to fruition. When those times come, when, not if, we will find safety, rest for our souls by running the presence of our anointed King, our Christ. How do we get there? What's the path? We got to go past a bloody, empty cross, past a silent, empty tomb, the feet of the once crucified, now risen and glorified Savior and King, whose name is Jesus. Dear Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you once more for this opportunity to proclaim your word, to proclaim your truth, to come to know you more fully, to find rest in you. Father, you know all the sufferings and all the evils that plague this church family, this flock, that plague us. Father, you are with us in the midst of all of that. Father, you care. Every single tear you take account of. Father, you won't let it go to waste. There is a purpose. There is a plan. There is more to the story, even though we haven't gotten there yet. Father, I pray that you would open our eyes and our hearts to all that you have for us, that we would run to your presence, remain in the presence of our anointed King. His Father, Jesus, you are the vine. We are the branches. We can do nothing apart from you. We have no life apart from you. You are everything to us. Father, be glorified. Let your will be done. Amen.